You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well. Well, I'm Chris. That's Ben. This is about Shakespeare. So now here's Beau and Marco.
Hello.
Are you suggesting that we would hog this conversation?
I'm suggesting that not only would you hog this conversation, but you would be justified in doing so, sirs. For you are both men who tread the boards, because who have performed the bards.
It's trod the boards.
Whatever.
I can't wait for Beau's soliloquy as his final thoughts.
I don't act anymore. They've just put a little flag on the boards that just say don't tread on me.
So from this point on, Beau and Marco agreed to do their entire review in Shakespearean verse.
Yeah, this is all going to be in iambic pentameter.
All improv. That's right. Guys are real talents. I'm just telling
harder
you.
To do than nope. It sounds.
I'm a free verse man. All
that's
the
right. This is just jazz over here, man. We ain't sticking to no beater, no tempo or beat.
So if you like it, feel free to snap your fingers at home. Right,
and well, it's odd because, you know, I will say about this movie, it has its moments, but it just doesn't scab.
This movie is always true. It is a story of the twilight years of William Shakespeare, both figuratively, literally, and cinematically.
Symbolically, for sure.
Yeah, because over half the movie is shot very distinctively at twilight.
Yes.
And there's at least 8 shots of, look, it's twilight of the sky. I mean, this did everything but have Robert Pattinson show up and look mournful.
I haven't seen a movie this much in candlelight.
Well, probably ever.
Yeah, I've seen horror movies that are
yeah,
better.
Yeah, it is kind of nice because it is actually lit how an Elizabethan home would be
true.
Lit.
It's like, very true.
Just
scandals.
Badly.
It's just all night.
Yeah.
If anything, they actually cheated. They're like, there's way too many candles in this scene.
Yeah, those things
they
are expensive.
They would have never wasted that many tallow candles on this.
So the opening scroll of text informs us that Shakespeare's play, Henry VIII, during a performance of that, the Globe Theater burnt to the ground. And after that, that was the last thing that Shakespeare ever wrote was that play. He never wrote again.
It's also that move, that play was also known as It's All Is True, which is where we drive the name of the movie.
Right.
Also probably the last time that props guy ever had a gig in London.
Yeah, misfired cannon.
Yeah.
So he returns home to Stratford-on-Anne Hathaway. And played by Judi Dench. Yeah, that's the porno version of this movie.
Which is odd, because in 30 years we're going to have Anne Hathaway and she's going to play Judi Dench.
True. I'm all for that, actually. Yeah. Wow. I just struck me how beautiful that was. That was your Shakespearean moment right there. And he has decided he is going to live in this bucolic Berg that his family in his months with his aging wife, who is much older than he is, like I said, played by Judi Dench. William Shakespeare is played by Kenneth Branagh, and live out his years gardening and puttering around the house, which everyone is like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And his family's like, honestly, we haven't seen you for the bulk of like our lives. Wow. So we don't even really know how to deal with you. And you come back here years after your son Hamnet was born. Maybe I kept going, did you guys misspell it on the ledger?
Yeah, it's Hamnet.
I know it was.
If you've read your Neil Gaiman, you would know this.
No, I did know it. I'm just saying it felt like in history, like somebody screwed up on the birth certificate.
It is. Yeah. they was just like, name Hamlet. Just, all right, Hamnet it is.
And my other son, Macduff. and who had died years earlier, and the family's already gone through their whole mourning period, but he comes back and now he wants everybody to mourn. And he's like, yeah, okay, this is awkward because we've all been through this and you're coming around just kind of like walking around the place, dragging your feet behind you. And everybody has their own issue, right? Yeah. He's got the one daughter who is married to a Puritan.
Dick.
Yeah,
a
Puritan Dick, who Shakespeare does not like because clearly Shakespeare was not a Puritan.
Well, shut down a lot of his theaters.
Yes, yeah. The Puritans do not like play. That's a whimsical nonsense, and God will have none of that.
Right. His other daughter has, you know, for lack of a better term, and seemingly appropriate for the time, has turned into an angry shrew. Mm. She's single and she's pissed off, and she's off at Dad.
She's more of a termagant. Yes.
Wow, I had no idea what that means, but okay.
I feel offended by it, but accept
it. Yeah, it feels like now we're going to get angry comments. A termagant? Do you know how offensive that term is?
It hasn't been since the 1600s.
Right, when they banned it. They were very woke in like 1611.
She's basically has become a bitter spinster.
Yes, and which they literally call her.
Yes, and
she's like, you know, 28, which is like the equivalent of being 55.
Yeah, right. And she's every conversation that she's in is just her yelling at her dad, basically, because as it becomes clear over time, there's multiple hidden secrets in this family that Shakespeare does not know about.
She's Hamlet's twin.
Yeah.
And she's a girl, and so she's obviously in the Elizabethan age, or the Tudorian age, or the Stuart age, because this James the First would be king. He is
well, we got that cleared up.
I was wondering.
she's kind of been she's a devalued as a human being because she's a woman, and
it's
not
very
much
clear.
That is expected of women.
And therein lies the rub of the film to some extent.
Yeah, because the portrait that starts to emerge from this is one of Shakespeare, who, as a young man, probably knocked up a much older woman, did the right thing and married her, had a couple kids, but then skipped the hell out of town, a town that has always treated him pretty poorly, with a chip on his shoulder, and
they make the revelation that his father was, he was a respected member of the community, and then he stole something, and he was the family
poached.
Name was blackmarked for a long time,
right.
Until Shakespeare, by virtue of his talents, became the richest guy, one of the richest guys in town, if not the richest,
and the most famous.
Yeah, I mean a guy who has personally talked to the king and queen,
right.
And this, of course, drives crazy a local nobleman in the town who wants nothing more than to shit on this guy.
He's really a useless character in this movie, too.
Right. You also have to remember that at this time, unless you had a royal patron, an actor was basically a vagrant.
Right.
You were basically loitering and could be arrested unless you were under the protection of some nobleman. And so in this world, in today's world, Shakespeare would be a rock star. But pretty much when he comes back to his little town, he's like, oh, you're a playwright. You can almost feel everybody just sticking their nose
like
up.
I went to London, became a pimp, and made a lot of money.
Yes. But there's that mix of people who come to him like jaws agape, almost afraid to talk to him because he's such, he's a superstar. Everybody knows who Shakespeare is. And there are those that are just like, I refuse to acknowledge that this makes you important in any way. You're just a son of a thief.
Yes, and including his son-in-law, who, as we have mentioned, Puritan.
Right.
But
right.
This is why the man is obsessed with his legacy and just trying to leave a mark. And again, this ties very much into the idea of the son, because a male heir is required. You really get the sense that Shakespeare's sole reason in life is to just restore the honor of the family name and make a mark that, will leave behind, that'll be left behind, but now he's just a man stuck with an elderly wife and a couple of daughters, one of whom is decidedly not getting married, and the other who is married to the same guy who would be happy to shut him down.
Yeah, who has a daughter, but it seems pretty clear these guys aren't having sex anymore.
Yeah.
They even make it pretty clear that he probably never had sex where he could have a child with her, where he basically forced her to sleep with somebody else to get a daughter to get Shakespeare's money.
They insinuate that briefly, that was a possibility.
That's one of several rabbit holes that are in this movie that they never really go down, which they don't need to, because in a lot of ways this movie's just kind of a bunch of rabbit holes stitched together.
And this is one of the reasons why Shakespeare is such an appealing subject for dramatization, apart from the immediate name recognition, there is enough mystery about the guy that you can speculate wildly, but enough documented evidence that no matter what theory you go with, you can lend some credence to it. And this felt like Shakespeare Conspiracy the movie. So every conspiracy theory about Shakespeare ever seems to make its way in here.
Well, and this is the same, they have the one with
the
one with Rhys Davies, which was I think he was supposed to be the eighth Earl of Oxford, or one of the many other people that people posit were the actual authors.
That's the only conspiracy they leave out, which I appreciate. The guy assumes that the man from Stratford wrote the plays, and he actually responds like, oh, you want to know how a guy who basically had a fifth grade education and then was poor and then moved to London and was an actor and became this good? He's like, because I was fucking good. Yeah. I did the work. I studied. I observed. And, you know, every time I read a theory about, oh, who really wrote Shakespeare's plays, my first thought is to myself is, I wonder what member of the nobility they're going to mention. Because it's always based on
British classist nonsense.
Yes. And the thing is, they're like, how could a man have, you know, quoted Ovid and done all of these things and then refer to Greek mythology and then know all of these? It's like, look, the man didn't know everything, but you seem to think that only someone who went to Cambridge or Oxford could make all of these literary allusions. But they never explain why Shakespeare knows, like, all the names of flowers, or what the different types of ropes on boats are, or what fishermen do for a living.
Nor do they explain why everyone who went to Oxford and Cambridge isn't writing Shakespeare's plays.
They're like, or are they?
Or are they?
And that's the thing, though. That is why he has the reputation he does, because he can write convincingly from whether, you know, kings or the lowest of people. He seems to have been a guy who just went through life always observing.
He had poetry in his soul.
Yeah, but as we see when he returns home, that he's kind of neglected some of his responsibilities in order to make a name for himself, and also is frequently just oblivious to everything that's going around him.
And admittedly, this is from a very, you know, modern lens, because back then it'd be like, yeah, I sent you money. Fuck off.
You know, I sent you money. You got a nice house. Yeah. I almost
what
never
else do you
beat
want
you.
Like,
have you ever seen, like, B.B. King did an interview on Fresh Air once, and Terry Gross just could not get over on him, because she was just like, well, what kind of relationship do you have with your many children? And he's like, I sent him money.
Yeah.
And she kept on trying to drill, and he's like, I told you, I send them money.
Yeah, I was a provider. Yeah. That's what I did. That was the job, the man's job. You know, and you get some of that part of Shakespeare.
This is like Shakespeare at his most languid and navel-gazing and most sad. And
he's abandoned, you know, he's abandoned writing, and he's, you know, gone back to Stratford, and now, you know, kind of all the chickens are coming home to roost as far as, like, oh, I had this kind of fabulous life in London, and now that I've left it behind, I'm having to deal with this other life that I could have had, and it turns out that you know, I wasn't particularly good at it.
And all he has left when he comes back is that concern, like, I want to heir, I want to make sure that there's a boy to get the money, and in his dreams, because Hamnet, in his mind, was the person who inherited his talent, you know, who was only 11 years old when he died, tragically, was like, that was the kid, and now what am I going to do? I got two daughters who literally can't read or write, so obviously that's not going to happen, so all I can do is
figure out,
but she's married to a guy who would never let her write
it. It felt like it was bouncing around on that, where it's like, oh, yes, every once in a while, let's remind you that he's really obsessed with the male heir. But the rest of the time, it's like, and let's go back to another vignette and another vignette. Most of it feels like it never goes anywhere, and honestly makes this 90-minute movie really feel it's 90 minutes.
But we get that one vignette that's with Ian McKellen, who comes in with gravitas so big as an actor that he needs a wheelbarrow to carry it in, going, excuse me.
This is my seat.
Yes, I know you've been looking at Kenneth and Judy for a while, but
now
McKellen
I'm
has arrived.
I know, it's like, how do you take a movie with those two big, really incredibly talented actors and makes them just disappear into the shadows? You have Ian McKellen show up with a crazy wig and just be like, I may have one scene in this movie, but damn, I'm gonna chew it up.
This is basically the Alec Baldwin, Glengarry Glenn Ross scene.
Yeah.
It's like, the movie's good, that's the scene everyone talks about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as we mentioned, there's a lot of things here that don't gel and feel disjointed. But even though this scene is definitely one of those, maybe the main one that doesn't really fit in, it's still so amazing, because it's more or less Kenneth Branagh, Ian McKellen, like, you know, having a poetry duel off, and at the same time telling everybody how much they fucking love Shakespeare.
Yeah. Right.
But herein lies part of the problem with that, because this is a low-budget film, and everybody involved in this movie is only doing it because, hey, Kenneth Branagh calls you. I mean, answer that call.
You say low-budget. I mean, this is $1.3 million.
Yeah.
Most people, can't get a car for that, it feels like, these days. Yeah. You know, it's right. That's, insanely low for any movie.
For the kind of cast he gets for this, I mean, most of these people make more than that as a fee.
Obviously, everybody on this is working for scale or whatever.
Right. But here is part of the problem, because I don't have a problem with the cheapness of it, because he makes the most of it, and it's a handsome-looking film, despite the budget. What happens is, you take a great actor like Ian McKellen, you give him these amazing scenes, you sit him on a chair, and basically just do a tight medium shot on him and let it roll for the next 5 minutes. That's cool, but it also feels like, oh, Ian's here as a favor. We've only got him for a day, so we're not going to do a lot of coverage. Just sit down, do your scenes with this floppy, horrible wig, and, you know, we're cool for today. And then, you know, Ken will come in and shoot his part tomorrow. To have these two titans of Shakespearean acting sharing a scene, but almost never in a frame together.
Right.
It's like the De Niro Pacino moment in Heat all over again. You almost have to, tell people, no, we assure you, they were there on the same day.
They did actually
really
have to do that.
They really were there on the same day. We promise you, even though it doesn't look it. And the thing that you can say about Branagh, who from the minute he's drew breath, just decided, I'm going to be the next Olivier. Yeah. That is who I'm going to be.
I am Shakespeare man.
And the one thing you can say about his Shakespearean output is it's always different. It's always interesting, and it's never been stagey. This is the first film he's ever directed, Shakespearean or not, that feels stage-bound. And it's frustrating because it makes a slow film feel much slower.
Well, I mean, I think part of that might be very intentional, certainly because a lot of it is set inside the almost claustrophobic feeling of this house, which is very intentional for sure. And B, there's a lot of stuff in here that is definitely an attempt to reflect themes from Shakespeare's tragedies.
Sure.
You know, even with him communicating with his imagined ghost of his son and stuff.
Yeah,
it's to give it a stagey, to make it feel to some sense like a theatrical production. But that's offset by the fact there's a lot of scenes of him out in this elegiac nature around him and just watching the leaves blow past and look at the beautiful scenery. It was almost like, it felt like you're trying to do two different things and they're not really working together.
And it also suggests that somehow Shakespeare's plays were stagey and static when they weren't. So I thought that too.
I mean, Christ sakes, the guy was so into it, he burnt down the fucking theater for the effect.
That's right. He's like, we're getting a cannon, goddamn. We're bringing a bear for this.
That's why Roland Emmerich wanted to make a Shakespeare movie.
That's right. So even that scene when they're showing the theater burning, it's like, oh, yeah, even then he's going to be dramatic in front of the flames, isn't he? Oh, look at Shakespeare.
Man, they should have had him walking in slow motion towards the camera away from the flames.
You know, it's like, oh, Kaiser Soze was Shakespeare all along.
That's the thing, though. Dude, if he had dropped his coffee mug at the end of the film, I would have been like, oh, man.
You know, it's got so many things that it's trying to do, which Shakespeare did very well, too. Shakespeare was one of those first guys who's just like, I'm going to throw every tone in the book.
I just want, at the very end, Branagh comes out of his coffin and he's like, but none of it really happened that way. Shakespeare!
Genius! No, there's so many
Judy Dench pulls off her face and it's been Ian McKellen the whole time.
I was Derek Jacobi the whole time!
it tries to do so much.
It's needed an M. Night twist.
And it just doesn't really hold up for me all the time, which is really disappointing because this movie is loaded with in-jokes that I think is going to play great to a theater crowd. But if you look at probably its closest cousin is Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
That film succeeds because A.
Distant cousins.
It's not very deep, but it also understands something that Shakespeare always understood, which is you play to the groundlings. You don't need to have a background in classical theater to appreciate Shakespeare in Love. You'll catch some of the little jokes, but there's something in there for everybody. This movie feels so attenuated and intellectualized who is doing this for?
Particularly the humor is niche. And
it's playing to the balcony
I found myself
seats.
About halfway through this going hey, why didn't they put this up on Netflix or BBC or something along those lines and trim it down to an hour? And I think that would have done this a lot of service because, you know, you might have had somebody going like, guys, we need to get this get this down to a solid hour.
Oh, and the writer Ben Elton is a guy who cut his teeth doing like the Young Ones and Blackadder.
Now you
told me with a scabrous wit.
You told me that, and I was just like, you're right. This would have been much helped by every 20 minutes or so. They're like, and now Motorhead.
That's right. You know, and I would have been all right with it because hey, you know, why not? You feel like this is a very funny guy who's holding back. It's like, no, I'm in serious mode now. But when he does allow the humor to come out, it breathes some much-needed life into this
movie. The thing is, me and Chris were talking about this, there's been a huge series of movies like this lately of, you know, classical figures in literature.
But they're end years.
Yeah, they're end years. And it's like, I don't want to see them at their worst moments. I want to see some of their highlights, like the one of Oscar Wilde was... Yeah. It's like, yeah, when he got to be Oscar Wilde, the, you know, dynamic, you know, hedonist that we all knew him as, he's fantastic
not
on screen.
Not the sad, dying,
which
like,
is 90% of the movie.
Poor,
like, when Shakespeare's mapping out his garden and he's, like, explaining to the maid why he's doing this, he's witty, he's, you know, full of life about it, he's explaining, yes, this is why theater is like this and that. It's like, yes, that's the witty Shakespeare that we want. And then it's like, and now I'm going to sit here and tell my daughter that... I don't hate her, but she's never fulfilled her life's duty, and I feel ashamed.
It's very doleful, and it's made all the more marginalized by the fact that like those moments like that, where you see where the film is injected with a little bit of life and humor, really come alive, only for you to sit through the next 15 minutes of it just pounding you down with no, this is a tragedy. Okay, guys, but maybe as you said, this shouldn't be like. It's kind of a hidden comedy. It's like there are jokes, but most of them are specifically for like the private rich people seats, like the thaumaturges in the crowd.
Those are the people who are actually paid extra money to just sit on the stage,
right?
And be seen.
I just most of this, I'm like, okay, I understand everything that's happening fully. I mean, maybe not get all the tiny little in jokes, but that's not essential to understand the movie. And there are moments that I think are incredibly well written. I think there's great performances all the way through this. But at the end, I was like, what was all that for? But let's go to final thoughts. Ben, get us started.
Yeah, so this movie overall, I kind of went into it hopeful. Brano, again, as we've talked about, has basically made Shakespeare his own and basically made it his career for the most part. And he does a fantastic job of it, as always. He is a consummate performer, knows what he's doing, and... Most of this film, as we said, is gorgeous, maybe a little overly dark. There's some of those scenes where he's sitting there talking to Judi Dench in the parlor, and all of a sudden his daughter just seems to appear out of nowhere because it's just a black hole in the wall that's like, was there a door there? Was she sitting in the shadow and I couldn't tell? Who the fuck knows? It just happens a lot.
It was that asshole from Brightburn.
But
yeah, I spent the whole movie looking into the negative space for when the Judith was going to come out.
Like, when they cue that lightning flash, you know you'll just catch a glimpse of her. Judith in the
background. And it's because you hate me, Father. It is me, the spinster.
I just want at some point go, God fucking damn it, stop doing that. No more. But yeah, the overall, the ghost of his son thing started pissing me off at a point. I'm like, I get it, you're trying to go with like, you know, a Shakespearean ghost thing, but it also... just felt so tacked on, even from, like, the first scene when he's, like, the first scene when he's trying to head home. He's not even at home. He's already talked to the ghost of his son. And then it kind of feels like they keep forgetting that that's a big part of the story that they're trying to focus on. And then it comes back up. So it just really feels – the movie feels so disjointed to me. And I don't know. The more I thought about it after we talked about it after the movie, I'm just like, the less I cared for this movie, the less I think I'll revisit it, no matter how good the performances are. Like, you'll see that Ian McKellen scene show up on YouTube probably at some point in, like, the next 3 years where people will be like, Ian McKellen killing it in a Shakespearean movie. It's like, cool.
And he does.
And that's going to be the most worthwhile thing to look up this movie for. Yeah. I doubt I'll ever revisit it. So I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 10 poems lying in a pond.
Marco?
You know, I also went into this movie with a lot of high hopes just based on the cast alone. Contrary to Chris, I actually... And Ben, I actually like the idea of exploring this period in Shakespeare's life. It was done better in Edward Bond's Bingo, but that's a much different type of show. But the thing is, it's been done before,
And I thought it would be interesting to see Kenneth Branagh's much more sentimental.
I mean, I wasn't joking about the Neil Gaiman thing. That's something that he explores in The Sandman in two particular instances.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of people have, there's a lot of mystery about what was Shakespeare doing during those last few years. What was going on in his mind?
What the fuck does second best bed mean?
Yeah, he was exactly.
He was paying Ben Johnson for writing his plays.
There you go. you know, but what I, or whoever.
He was smuggling tobacco and papers.
That's right. He was Jack the Ripper. Boy, Jack the Ripper must be really old.
Well, considering he was also the Boston Strangler and the Zodiac Killer, I'd say yes.
Wait a minute. It's around.
God damn it. You're telling me Ted Cruz wrote the sonnets?
That's what I'm saying. It all makes sense if you put it together. I want you to look at my board with pictures tied together with yarn.
Why am I so persecuted?
But, you know, I did have those high hopes, and I do love the idea of exploring this period of Shakespeare's life. Unfortunately, this does feel like a first draft. All the elements are there, but they needed to tighten this and make it flow together. And unfortunately, Branagh's stagey direction actually sucks a lot of the life out of it and makes that disjointedness feel much more static and clear to the audience. I mean, there are shots that are held so long that I was actually looking at, you know, the clotted blots of dried spirit gum holding his beard on. I should not have that much time to see that the crepe hair had not been properly brushed through. So, yeah, way too long on that.
Oh, checking the audience to make sure time hadn't stopped.
Yeah, you know. So, anyhow, bit of a missed opportunity. Worth checking out if you like those little theatrical in-jokes. But other than that, I would say that this is a movie made for a very small audience. And if you're not into that, don't waste your time on it. I give this 6 out of 10 Bavarian coasts. Bo?
Yeah, unfortunately, and I went in with somewhat mediated hopes because it's still a fucking biopic, and you know I feel about those, and it suffers from the same thing that a lot of biopics suffer from, which is if you know the history of Shakespeare, what little there is of it, you kind of know what's going to happen at the end. And I think I will say this: I found something interesting in nearly every little bit. But those bits were never stitched together well enough to make a competent through line for me. So I would get interested, and then I'd be shunted off to something else, and I'd have to build interest all over again. And yeah, it doesn't work. And I like Branagh quite a bit, but he is admittedly he can be a hit and miss kind of guy, and I think this is more miss than hit in a lot of ways.
It's a palpable hit?
Yes, there's still some great stuff here as far as incredible performances, and like I said, those little scenes in and of themselves, they work, you know, but it's kind of like, I don't know, watching Game of Thrones. Some of that stuff was really good.
Look, the dragon CG was really good, though.
Here we go.
Hey, man, we are contractually obligated to talk about Game of Thrones and everything for at least another week.
No. He's been dying to get on mic and bitch about Game of Thrones. I was like, well, no Game of Thrones before.
Inevitably, you kind of walk out going like, well, I saw some things. I saw some good things. But I didn't really necessarily see a great story. And it's really sad when you're doing a story about the greatest storyteller of all times, and you can't stick that. This definitely needs some tightening up, needs some editing. It would probably have been better off as a 1-hour special. And yeah, I think when it comes down to it, the deeper interest for an audience here is going to be people that are Shakespeare fanatics, of which I know many, and they're going to get a deal out of this, and they're going to get a new perspective. But you know, for the rest of us, it's at best wait until it's streaming somewhere. I give it 6 out of 10 Dead Hollyoaks.
Yeah, I was 10 minutes into this when I was like, oh boy, this was not made for me at all.
Yes,
I'm going to do my best to class it up. mentally. I'm going to stop fantasizing about the weird shit I fantasize about, like with what your you average super slow movies. Oh man, I'd still do Judi Dench. Yeah. I don't care. She's Judi Dench.
Pretty much.
She'd be like 120 and still be like, sup?
Yeah.
Sup. Sup, Anne Hathaway? I'll just picture that in my head. Now, I couldn't stop thinking the whole review about Anne Hathaway playing Judi Dench in 30 years. I was like, God damn it, Poe. You have that stuck in my head. But that was this movie. I was so desperate for entertainment value, I kept having to stamp down, like, entertaining. Oh, what if this happened now? That's, you know, Ian McKellen accidentally calls Shakespeare Charles. It's fine. There's points in this movie I genuinely enjoyed, but there's a lot, like, that's just so fucking on the nose. I can't remember if I said this earlier in the review or not, but, like, it's so clearly one of those Twilight of the Year movies, and the film, like, 8 times shows, look, it's Twilight outside, and you're like, oh my god, we got it! Holy shit! Like, it's just, yeah, all right.
Like, I expected at some point it was just gonna, at the end, break into heavenly shades of night, so falling, right? It's Twilight time!
I think this is fine. It's one of those movies my mom might really like, and great. I don't think it's a terrible movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's really hard for me to feel like I'm even qualified to judge this thing because it's so pointedly.
It's never stopped you before.
No, and it never will. But so pointedly not made for me. And even like you guys are big fans of Shakespeare, I have a tentative understanding of Shakespeare stuff. I mean, there's like some of the big ones I've seen multiple productions of, and even Romeo and Juliet at points, I go, wait, what's happening? And I've probably seen 17 different versions of it. Yeah. It just, that type of verse never worked for me. And this is not done in that kind of verse. I don't want you to think this is done as a film that's everybody speaking Shakespearean. It's very easy to understand how people are conversing here. But it's just kind of dull. You know, it's just kind of there.
Yeah.
Like, it should be so much better. There's so many moments you're like, oh, this is almost good.
Yeah.
But it's not something you can totally throw out the window either. The performances are desperately strong here throughout, I think. It's just there's a lot of bad directorial choices. And Branagh has been a mixed bag his whole career as a director, where he's done stuff that's been incredibly strong and he's done stuff that's been stilted and weak. And this kind of falls under the latter for me. So I guess I'm going to give this 6 out of 10 upside down male Ophelias. Just saying.
Sure.
See, I might as well make an obscure reference as well for my thing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, this movie became a game of just listening for when Bo and Marco
a game of what?
Like, Thrones?
Say it.
It's a Thrones.
Oh, God, no. You don't get this one, Bo. It's not for you.
It's like War of the Roses, but with tits and dragons.
Is it Game of Chernobyl or Game of Westworld? I need another game.
Game of Barry? It should be Game of Barry.
It's probably going to be
Game. I'm sorry, Ben. What were you saying?
I was just saying it became a great time just listening for when Bo and Marco both laugh and go, oh, that's the reference I missed. Okay, good.
No, seriously.
Like, so those are the two smug bastards in the audience.
And there'd be like jokes that aren't even about Shakespeare. There are jokes related to stuff that like Ben Johnson wrote, and I was like, who the fuck knows what Ben Johnson wrote?
The not being able to speak Greek and Bohemian border joke was solid.
That was great.
Awesome.
I think the only other person in our crew who would laugh at this would be Kat.
Yeah, and she would come out going, that was amazing.
Kat, when we speak of the niche audience,
that's
we
Kat.
Are speaking of Kat.
It is just Kat.
Exactly. God love her.